Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Join us for a journey as we go back to the great civilizations of the past. Who were the people? What were they like? How did they begin? And how did they end? Let's find out on this episode of Fan of History. Hello, Dan.
Hello, Bernie.
Nice to talk to you again today. This is going to be a great episode.
I have been waiting for this episode for such a long time. We have talked about Ashurbanipal in many episodes now, and we have mentioned the library, but this is the single one greatest achievement. Ashurbanipal brought the Assyrian Empire into its biggest time. The Assyrian Empire was never as big as under Ashurbanipal, but this is a much greater achievement.
Yes, for sure. I know you've really been talking about this since I started doing this podcast with you. And so here we are, finally doing the episode on Library of Ashurbanipal.
And just to put things in perspective, this is the biggest collection of texts before the Library of Alexandria. Hmm. So in all world history, before the Library of Alexandria, this is the biggest library.
Yeah, amazing, really. They really, it's a fascinating story. I think the listeners are really going to love it. I've been immersed in it for the past couple of months myself.
Do you know the author H.E. Wells?
Yes.
He called the Library Ashurbanipal, quote, "the most precious source of historical material in the world," end quote.
That's not hyperbole.
No, it isn't. And it is like the dream of an archaeologist to discover something like that.
Oh, amazing.
And it happened to Austin Henry Layard.
Yes.
One of those British archaeologists stalking the world in the 19th century, taking everything. And this guy was extremely successful. He had the time of his life. He discovered a lot of stuff about the Assyrians. And he excavated Nimrud and Nineveh.
Yeah. Amazing cast of characters that was. That's a whole... The archaeology of how they found it is a great story as well, which we'll get into a little bit too.
Yeah, and remember that during the 18th century, people even thought that the Assyrians were fictional.
Yeah.
That they didn't know anything about the Assyrians except for the parts in the Bible. And those weird legends that the Greeks and the Romans had.
Yeah. But I got to tell you, I find that a little funny because in the Bible, the Assyrians are not like just sort of mentioned like Atlanteans or giants or something. I mean, the whole siege of Jerusalem is a big story. I mean, you know, they named King Sennacherib and everything.
Yes.
I think it's maybe sort of like the East versus West bias of the time, you know, where they the East was not a big deal to the Westerners, and they were digging up things and looking from Greece and Romans and things like that.
Now I'm getting into history in the Bible stuff, and we know a guy who's better at that.
He is.
But I think the Bible was very questioned in the 18th century as well, as during the era of Enlightenment, that, oh, the Bible is just a fairy tale.
Yes. And actually, this story goes along with it, because when they were finding, you know, when they found the library, they were deciphering things. They were, in other words, they were showing things that, oh, this was in the Bible, and now we found it in this library.
Yeah. Okay, so Austin Henry Layard is in the royal palace of Sennacherib, the Southwest Palace in 1849. And he discovers a big library.
Yeah.
But it's like he's discovering a lot of stuff. He doesn't have time to handle it. It's like, whoa.
Right.
So much stuff going on. So 3 years later, Hormud Rassam, Layard's assistant, discovers another library in the palace of Ashurbanipal. And they sort of mix up all the stuff they find in these two libraries. So we don't know which text came from which library.
Right. Isn't that crazy? So, yeah, because, you know what? It's probably all Sennacherib's known his luck. He always gets no credit. It's probably really the library of Sennacherib.
Probably. But I bet Ashurbanipal was using it.
Yeah. Yes.
And so stuff reached Europe, and then it was like, oh, where did this come from? Well, we'll credit it all to the library of Ashurbanipal.
Right.
Okay, let's get into the stuff. We talked so much about Ashurbanipal. Do we need to explain his background, why he cares so much about texts?
Well, I think we do know that he cares about them because he writes, right? We know that. Although, wasn't it funny that I think you watched it too? Irving Finkel said if you ever know Irving Finkel, he's a white-haired Assyriologist from the British Museum, and he says that he thinks the other kings could write, but we know Ashurbanipal was very proud of how much he could read and write, and he could read and write other languages and so on.
It always struck me as a very weird thing that only one king could read and write. But if another king could read and write, they were probably not that good and not as good at it as Ashurbanipal.
Yeah, I think
so. So he mastered both Akkadian and Sumerian, and of course cuneiform.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, I wonder if some of the other kings could read, but the writing was really what was Ashurbanipal was so proud of, because he was such a good, he had such good handwriting, and he could write so well.
Yeah, I think that might be the difference.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, Ashurbanipal realized that the old systems of writing were being replaced by that fancy alphabet.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, oh, you only need to know like 30 characters instead of thousands. And these old languages were being replaced by Aramean. So he realized that, wow, these thousands of years that have gone before me, all the knowledge, all the text, they will be lost. And I must save them. It's me, Ashurbanipal, who must save all the texts of the world.
Yeah. He does have a, mostly Assyrian kings, especially him, they'd have a sort of a superiority complex and a god complex, I would say.
Oh, yeah. So he sent scribes into every region of the empire to collect all ancient texts they could find. He hired scholars and scribes to copy texts, mainly from Babylonian sources then, because they had a lot of texts. But then he instructed his armies to, like, find texts, take them, bring them to me.
Right.
And we know he did a lot of fighting, so there was a lot of opportunities for getting texts for the king.
Yeah, that's a good point. They found a note. I think they found it in Borsippa, though. But it was one of his, it was a tablet, small, but it was sort of like an order saying, To, you know, he would have given to his armies and his people that they would go to another library and say, you know, the king of Assyria, Ashurbanipal, king of the world, demands your, you know, we want these texts. You know?
Yes, you can either give the text to Ashurbanipal or try to keep them from him.
Yeah, exactly. Or we'll write it on your skin.
Yes.
Like, what, not while your skin is still attached to your body.
I'll do a brief overview of the contents and then we'll go into details.
Okay.
So the Royal Library consists of maybe 30,000 tablets and writing boards. And the majority of them are very damaged. They are fragmented. And you can deduce from the fragments that the number of tablets that existed in the library at the time of destruction was close to 2,000, perhaps. And the number of writing boards were maybe 300. Oh, most of the texts were legislation, foreign correspondence, engagements, aristocratic declarations, and financial matters. And the sort of rest of the texts were divinations, omens, incantations and hymns to various gods, some medicine, astronomy and literature. But only 10 of the texts were rhythmic literary works such as epics and myths.
Yeah.
So very little fiction, but that is very representative of the ancient world before Ashurbanipal.
Yeah, I think so.
We do have the Epic of Gilgamesh. The best best copies of it come from the library.
Yeah, which is a great story, and we're going to actually we're going to have a special episode just on that. So we won't get into details of the Epic of Gilgamesh, but that was a major find, obviously, in that library.
Did we talk about Hillary Clinton on the podcast?
You mentioned it, and I Googled you. Tell us about that again.
So suddenly my Epic of Gilgamesh in 5 minutes video that I made on the Fan of History YouTube channel, it became very popular. And apparently Hillary Clinton's emails had been published and there was a reference to the Epic of Gilgamesh.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I haven't seen the reference itself, but it was some conspiracy theory that people were like, talking about Epic of Gilgamesh, being hostile to Hillary Clinton.
Ay, ay, ay. People don't like Hillary Clinton. Some people really don't around here.
Maybe they thought Trump were Enkidu or something like that.
Yeah, it could be that. Or maybe Hillary Clinton is a lizard or she's a, you know, Satan-worshipping, blood-drinking, you know. Which actually, that's part of the QAnon philosophy. I don't know if you realize that conspiracy that Hillary Clinton drinks the blood of children.
Oh, that's bad. Yeah. Stop that, Hillary.
Yeah.
Why?
That's just crazy.
Yeah.
So it may be her emails could have had something to do with Saddam Hussein, actually, because I kind of Googled it, and then in this book I recently got from, oh, that's so funny, I got a book from my library. I was like, I need to go to the library. So I went to my library, and I got a book on how they dug up Gilgamesh in the library of Ashurbanipal. And so Saddam Hussein was a very big fan of the Epic of Gilgamesh. And he is actually wrote some novels. So it's crazy.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So that could be somewhat too why they were in the emails.
The other great hits in the library is the Enuma Elis creation story, the myth of Adapa, the first man, and a story known as The Poor Man of Nippur.
Yeah, that's a good one.
But there's a lot of Babylonian texts, mainly in two different groups. Literary compositions such as divinations, religious, lexical, medical, mathematical, and historical texts, as well as epic and myths on the one hand, and legal documents on the other hand. The Babylonians love their legal documents.
Yeah.
So we have 1,128 Babylonian tablets and fragments concerning legal documents, contracts, and administrative texts. So well-organized Babylonians.
Yeah, I mean, that's what writing was for, right? Keeping track of all that kind of stuff. we probably won't have, if our civilization keeps going the way it is with our computers and everything online, we probably will have nothing. if everything gets destroyed, because definitely rocks and I should say clay tablets are easier to save than floppy disks.
You know about the long-term storage problem of nuclear waste?
Yeah.
Yeah, so they have to find a way to communicate to future civilizations that don't dig here.
Oh, yeah, it's right.
Really bad stuff, but you can't use writing. So you have to like find symbols that will be universal. So what they're actually doing is going back to ancient symbols and say, okay, we understand this, or do we? And we can use something like that.
Wow, that's a good idea. I did read about it. It's amazing.
Yeah, so you can like, is a skull, a skeleton skull, and some bones, is that a symbol of death? For some kids, it's a symbol for pirates.
Oh, right.
So you can't be sure of any symbols, how they will be interpreted in the future.
I guess pirates is the symbol of death, of being the symbol of pirates is still a symbol of like, stay away.
Yeah, but pirates are like something funny.
That's true. Now they're like fun.
At this point.
That's true.
There is a lot of lexical text and sign lists in the library. That is basically interpretation notes. You can read really old symbols. So your skilled scribes can't read 2,000-year-old symbols, but with these sign lists, they can.
Oh, yeah, like a dictionary, you know, like a encyclopedia, that yes. kind of thing. Yep.
Yeah.
Of course, that helped the translators pretty good. It's like a Rosetta Stone of a sort.
So a lot of texts are in Akkadian, in cuneiform script, but many of the tablets are hard to discern where they came from. Many tablets are in Neo-Babylonian script, and some are also in Assyrian. They are organized based on shape.
Yeah.
So if you have a tablet and it's four-sided, you know that that's a financial tablet.
Right.
If you have a round tablet, it's agricultural information. But we do have a lot of tablets in the library, and tablets were probably not that dominating, so there were a lot of text in the library that had not survived.
Yeah, probably a lot of it was written, and they just didn't make it.
Yeah, they were written on wood, on wax tablets,
oh, yeah,
and
that
stuff
too.
Like that. So yeah. They didn't make it. And of course, the Phoenicians and Egyptians used a lot of papyrus. Some papyrus probably made it into the library as well, but that doesn't survive.
No, especially the fire, because the fire burned up all that, but actually, you know, helped the tablets last because it baked them even further. But the paper.
That's amazing.
It is.
We're kind of spoiling the great event of 612 BC, but we have to talk about it
yeah.
when we come to the library. Because, and I'm so surprised that the library actually survived. Because in the downfall of Nineveh in 612 BC, the Babylonians, the Scythians, the Medes, and everybody else were there and ravaged the city. They destroyed a lot of walls and houses and statues, but somehow the library survived, and there was a great fire that actually baked the clay cuneiform tablets.
Right. Yeah.
But then I think the library must have been blocked or something because they didn't sack it.
Yeah, maybe all the walls fell on it and that kind of thing.
I bet they did.
They said they definitely smashed the tablets, some of them. Irving Finkel was saying that they could tell that some of them, the way they were broken, were, you know, they were smashed. And they did chip off Ashurbanipal's face, right, from a lot of the reliefs.
Yes. I bet the Babylonians saw a value in the library, but the Scythians and the Medes, they probably didn't mm-hmm. care a lot for it.
Yeah, maybe the Babylonians took some of their... Maybe some of those tablets that they found in Babylon were originally in the library and they took them back.
Yeah, maybe they were.
You know?
This 19th century British giant stealing campaign
yeah.
worked great. So the British Museum has 30,943 tablets. But these are fragments.
Yeah.
And despite 150 years having passed, they haven't finished cataloging all of this. It's very hard to tell which parts belong together and stuff like that. So they believe they have 10,000 texts in the British Museum.
And probably a ton of them are super actually boring, believe it or not, after a while, where it's like, you know, we sent a sheep to, you know, Joe Smith. Obviously, his name wasn't Joe Smith. But Joe Smith, 10 sheep, you know, or just...
Yeah, and probably very redundant.
Redundant. Like,
yeah, that it's the same text on a lot of places, like laws and stuff.
Exactly. I mean, they're interesting to go through at some point, but... then, you know, of course, then you find these amazing tablets while they're while they were doing it. So, yeah, they've been translating these all along. Like, so it's funny when you know how you say, like, they were taking all these treasures out of the Middle East, or out of the Near East and stuff. But like, when they were taking them out, this was part of the Ottoman Empire, the guards and stuff were, like, laughing at them because they're literally, like, boxes of stone, like, rocks, you know?
Yes.
It's like, what are you going to do with that? Because they were worried about them taking statues and things like, you know, nice things like that. And they're like, no, we're taking the rocks. What? They're laughing at them.
No, you can have the rocks.
Yeah, take these rocks.
Keep the gold.
And then, you know, now there's literally, could you imagine the puzzle this is, right? I mean, it's like the ultimate puzzle. It's a box. You have all these rocks and with little marks on them. And they put them together. They're still putting them together.
I bet it's a lot of work. But imagine a world where we did not find the library.
Well, we wouldn't have all this. I mean, right?
This podcast would have been much shorter. We would have been in the 300s by this point.
It's so true. I know. What if they find another? If they find another library somewhere, like in, like, you know, like the Phoenicians or something, we could start all over again.
Wow, that would be great.
I'll never have to leave the 600s BC. If they didn't find it, you're right, we wouldn't have all that stuff. I mean, all the stuff that when I'm you know, when I do the research, and I'll say it's, and I'll talk about this in a little bit here too, like, you know, I got this from the Rassam cylinder, and I got this from, you know, Sennacherib's annals, and yada yada yada. Well, these are the things that they found. They weren't there, and, you know, you read them, they're amazing. Or like the Esarhaddon Treaty. I mean, maybe that was found other places, but, you know, there was these guys that found this stuff and translated it.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Yeah. Let's go through. This was the basic overview of the library.
Yeah.
Now let's go deeper into the contents.
Yes. So, oh yeah, the contents is amazing. Like we said, a ton of the things are smashed, right? So you can't really, so they couldn't really just say, well, look at this, we found this. So they were going through this for years and years and years. So Layard finds the stuff in the late 1840s. He went once, and like you said, he found Sennacherib's thing. And then they went back, and that's a cool story. So they go back. So layered really, and it's so funny because Rassom doesn't get a lot of credit, you know, until you take a deeper dive. So layered goes back, and Rassom is in, so I'm sorry, let me, so Rassom is an Iraqi. He's an Assyrian, basically. His mother was Syrian. His father was Iraqi. He's from Mosul, and that's where Nineveh was, where they were excavating. So he met Laird.
He's a local boy.
He's a local boy, exactly. His brother was sort of a local official, and he met Rassom, and he was about 20 years old, and he met Laird, and Laird hired him as his paymaster. So after, the, you know, he became... they became close, and he was very smart, and he was a local boy, like I said, so he could get things done. You know, he could hire people. He was very good. So anyway, he goes back, and the second time in the later 1840s, so first they had dug it up, and then he went back, and there was this whole tension with the French. The French also had rights to dig in this area. This is kind of like it was an imperial... sort of a sparring match. They weren't actually fighting, but it was for prestige. So anyway, Rassom sort of...
It's like the space race.
Correct, so exactly.
For old relics.
Exactly. So it's funny, because even they had the French found the Rosetta Stone, but the British got it, and it's in the British Museum. So that's the Rosetta Stone from Egypt, sorry, where they, you know, they were, it was, that was written in Greek, it was written in the Demotic script that we've talked about, and hieroglyphics. So that's how they translated hieroglyphics. So,
yeah.
And there was a similar thing in the cuneiform. So anyway, when Rassom goes the second time, he tricks the French guy. He digs in moonlight. And while he's digging, he kind of has a feeling. He goes, I think I knew where this would be. And while he's digging, the second or third night, a 15-foot area just collapses, huge, right? And that's when he finds the library. I have the chills literally thinking of this. He could see, first he sees the, like a relief, because they've seen reliefs before. He starts to see one of Ashurbanipal's reliefs, and then when they hit it, boom, the whole thing, he could see the whole relief. And that's when he found Ashurbanipal's library, where all those tablets were. I mean, they say they got mixed with Sennacherib's, but, you know, they knew this was a library for sure.
Amazing.
So then it took them, you know, years to translate all this stuff. Just like you said, they're still putting it together. And as they're putting it together and learning how to translate it, that's a cool story too. Could I tell that?
Yes, go ahead.
So there's this other, these are like all these like classic British Victorian guys, you know? You know the guy at Monty Python? I always use Monty Python. The guy from The Meaning of Life who, like, loses his leg to a tiger.
Don't remember.
He's just laying in there. He's like, sir, what's wrong with your leg? I think I've lost my leg. It might have been, I think it was a tiger. Like, could you go out and find my leg, boys? Like, very calm. So these are these kind of guys. They were like the 1820s, 1830s, you know, 1840s. So they were learning cuneiform before this was discovered. So this was, you know, in the 20s and 30s, they were translating cuneiform. So this guy, Sir Henry Rawlinson, he's the guy who would, like, lose his leg from a tiger and say, oh, I lost my leg. So, like, even his son became a general in World War I, and he's the one who broke through the Hindenburg line. So it's a prestigious family. So he... In addition to being a diplomat and a parliament and a soldier, while he was a soldier overseas in the, you know, Ottoman Empire in that area, he started learning cuneiform and Persian. So there's this, it's sort of like the Rosetta Stone of cuneiform. There's this huge monumental inscription from Darius the Great, and it's, you know, on a sheer cliff. And you can't, you know, they don't have cameras, and it's up high, and, you know, they could just see it's cuneiform. But it's also was written in Persian. And so he could kind of, it was sort of like a Rosetta Stone. So he climbs up this thing so precariously and copies it with a pencil. And then he tries to get to another part, and he almost dies. So then he hires a local boy, you know, like a, what they do, the British would do, right? Just like, oh, get some native. So this kid climbs up the thing so precariously and just makes a pencil scratching of it. You know, this took years. And then over the years, he translates to cuneiform and writes some books. And so people start learning it. And then just lay people learned it. And that's how they had people help translate it. The British Museum would let people come in a couple of days a week to that would like just learned cuneiform that wanted to translate it, which I wonder if any, you think people would do that today? I mean, I guess we have sort of.
Well, there is a lot of people who know cuneiform today, but I think it is extremely hard to learn.
Oh, yeah, I get. I mean, do you think somebody, I mean, just the fact of just lay people just saying, oh, I'm going to learn another language and translate that. I guess, I don't know. Kind of like this.
I think they're all professionals.
Yeah. Well, so, yeah, there was like priests who could who learn it. So there's one guy who's an amazing character, too. His name is George Smith. He's the one who found Gilgamesh. And he taught himself cuneiform from learning all this and languages. And he was like 20 years old when he started to go to the library. And they realized, hey, this guy knows it. And then one day, he's finding all this cool stuff, you know?
Wow.
Like, oh, for example, let me tell you for example.
But this is the kind of stuff people could do when they didn't have Netflix.
Exactly. That was my point. I said, do you think people would do this today?
No, they would be too busy on
something. That was right. If there was something, like we might find like an alien planet and they're like, I'd watch the movie instead.
I'll wait for the Netflix documentary.
Yeah, Netflix do it. But he found, for example, his first important discovery was the date of the payment of the tribute of Jehu, king of Israel, to Shalmaneser III.
Wow.
Right? So that's why he started. They were very religious. You know, they were very pious Christians. So they were looking for stuff that, you know, triangulated with the Bible. Oh, this is another very important thing he found. He found that there was an eclipse on the 15th of June, 763 BC, on the 15th of June, there was an eclipse that had been known through astronomy, but then they found it on a tablet. So that is the keystone that is used to date things from the ancient Near East. That particular thing that he found in those tablets by, you know, saying that there was an eclipse, that they said that this was this date. You know, probably said, you know, the date, the time to pick onions. You know how we always find those things? Yes. And, you know, this, and the year of this, that. Because it didn't say. It was 15763. It said something that they were able to use. But that's in a specific date. So by going, because something will be 10 years later than that, et cetera. So that's super important. And he also found the date of an invasion of Babylonia by the Elamites in 2280 B.C., so those are just some of the cool things to nerds like us that we found. But that main thing he found was the flood. So he finds the flood tablet. So it was like there was a boat, there was a storm, there was animals on the boat, the boat landed on a mountain, he sent out a bird. It was just like Noah. So they said he got so excited when he found it, he started undressing. We don't know if he, like, took all his clothes off and, like, eureka, or just unbuttoned his shirt. But he said he just, like, completely lost it and just started undressing. And there he finds the Epic of Gilgamesh, the flood tablet. And then from there he found the rest of them.
Wow.
So, yeah. And then, okay, like I still get excited about this George Smith story. So there was a piece missing. Eventually, and then we could talk about that after. Eventually he goes back to where he talks the museum into letting him go back to Iraq, and he finds the piece that was missing like 20 years later. He goes back to where Rassam had dug, and he just within a week he finds it.
That's sheer luck.
I know, but the thing is, he knew what it was he was looking for.
Wow.
You know, he kind of knew he knew the cuneiform, he knew the shape.
But you should mention that the excavations themselves took 80 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is a long time.
And they probably, if they found that today, they'd probably only be like a tenth through it, don't you think? The way they so much more carefully dig now.
Yeah, and that would probably be very good for it.
Of course. We might not have had all this information by now, but
There is a Swedish archaeology site from the end of, from the migration period, like 400-500 AD, mm-hmm. where they have discovered it's the site of a mass murder. It's the site of a massacre.
Oh.
And I do make a Swedish podcast about mass murder. So I'm very interested in that. I could I can combine true crime and history. That's two things I love. But the excavation has been going on for 11 years, and they have excavated 11%.
Exactly.
So they are doing 1% a year.
That's
so
how they
I
do
have
it.
To wait 89 years before I can podcast about it.
Hey, how about we can have your murder podcast and your fan of history podcast. We can go visit that dig. We'll have a little trip.
Yes. Yeah. Actually, there might be episodes from my mass murder podcast that I'll translate to English because they are historical mass murders.
Ah, I'll definitely like to listen to that. And if you do that, that would be like a Rosetta Stone of the future.
Yes, we did. We did find, we have like an episode that is, it's about a mass murder in Stockholm in 1392. And it was so hard to find all the information that we now have the prime academic text in that episode for that mass murder, which is quite stunning. Nobody had studied it since, really, and published a text about it since the 1850s.
So, you know, that makes me think that I was wrong when I said, what would people do today? And so that's exactly what you did, right? Like, just how George Smith decided to just, as a volunteer, decipher that, you actually contributed to history the same way as him.
Oh, it was my writer that did that.
Well,
but I encouraged him.
Well, you're like layered.
Yes.
Because Rassam was an Iraqi. He didn't get a lot of credit over the years. I mean, the book I read really goes through it, and it's great. It's called The Buried Book. It's about Gilgamesh. They found, like we said before, they found boring things, but they found amazing things like the Epic of Gilgamesh. And how about, did you see where they had that dictionary of different types of tables that Irving Finkel talked about?
Yeah.
And they, how the line, it was a, so this tablet, they wasn't that broken, I don't think. But, you know, it's like perfect lines drawn, you know, straight. And then it would have on one side a description of a table, different kinds of wood. And then it written in other languages or just, you know, sort of a dictionary to describe it. So there was all definitely kind of stuff like that in there. But a lot of scholars think that that one of the major reasons that Ashurbanipal was going around looking for all this stuff is he was looking for secret information, you know, magical spells and things like that.
Well, they are so superstitious.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of astrological reports in the library as well.
Yes. They help in some, they're very, they were very cause and effect, which is a natural thing for humans. I always say that, you know, sort of cause and effect. If this happened in the sky, then this happened in the ground, then that must mean that's what happens.
But yes.
Same thing with, you know, sheep's livers and that kind of thing.
They would have been terrible poker players because the cause and effect is the most like common error in thinking in poker instead of doing the math.
Ah.
I used to be a poker pro at one point.
I can believe you would be.
Poker players are almost as superstitious as Assyrians.
I believe baseball players, sports players. Yeah, superstition runs through the human race for sure.
Imagine that you are an archaeologist or a cuneiform knowledgeable person and you have this tablet in front of you and you want to find out what it's about and you start interpreting it and then you find out it's an astrological report.
Right.
It's like, no.
All right, I know. Yeah, so Irving Finkel, he could, and a lot of these other guys too, probably Karen Radner too, she reads cuneiform. They could start reading the handwriting. They can tell that, you know, this is this scribe or this guy's got, you know, they could start telling the scribe's handwriting, which becomes in very handy where they could find a little piece of a rock, you know, and then they're like, oh, I know what this, I know exactly what tablet this goes to because it's this guy's handwriting.
Wow.
Right? They also found a letter from Shamashuma-Ukin to Ashurbanipal, where he's annoyed at Ashurbanipal, and he references, do you remember when we were kids and you used to annoy me when we used to play that dice game? That's just awesome. what's saying about Rassom, though, like the rat, when I'll say we got this from the Rassom cylinder, they found that in there. So different, or some of the other ones are called Rassom cylinders. So I think there's a couple of Rassom cylinders. I'll have to clarify that on another episode. But a lot of times when I'll be, you know, the long, long King reports from Ashurbanipal or Sennacherib come from these big cylinders. And they're, I mean, they has all the information, everything we talk about, everything you find in Cambridge Ancient History, all that was found by these guys in that library.
Wow.
How about they found, this was amazing to me, there's only two little fragments, but they, on the back of the tablets, they would write, this is the property of Ashurbanipal's library, and things like that, you know, don't take it or we'll flay you and kill you, that kind of stuff. And they had symbols for that. And sometimes they would forget to write it on there. And
imagine what would happen to you if you were late returning a book to Ashurbanipal's library.
I want to
you
do a cartoon.
You better return it on time.
Hi, I'm returning this book, and it's a little late. It's about a week late. What is my fee? We're cut off your fingers.
Oh.
2 weeks, we would have killed your family.
Those are the heads of the people who return books late here.
Oh, yeah. Those are the heads of the people who turn books late. That's so funny. That's a good point, though. That actually, it wasn't that kind of library. It wasn't like people could just go in there and, you know, only certain people were allowed in there for sure. The hell, secret texts, you know?
Of course.
Yeah, so they would write on the back of the thing, and they had these symbols, and sometimes they'd forget to do it before, when the tablet was dry. So they would have to scratch it in there. But they found these two tablets where they were too dry, and they couldn't scratch it in there at all. So this is amazing to me. They wrote notes on it in ink, in cuneiform. So like,
in ink?
Yeah, in ink. So that's weird. Like, you would think, why, you know, cuneiform is made because it's got grooves. When you look at these tablets, they look just like a bunch of bumps. You can't tell. But when you look at it, with the scholars who will use it to translate it, it's lines and arrows and stuff like that. It doesn't show the depth. You know, everybody really think that the scribes would actually ever use ink because it's a whole different thing, but apparently they did. They have these two tablets, and they use ink, but it's written in cuneiform, which is really cool.
It just seems so much easier to use ink than to actually carve the stuff.
Well, yeah, for sure. That's why, so when you see, there's a famous picture they'll show, they're actually Assyrian war correspondents. They're at, you know, battle, because it's on, you know, war reliefs, and they're writing. And the one guy has a clay tablet, and the other guy has a paper and a pen. So it's been assumed that the guy writing in paper and pen was writing in Aramaic. Irving Finkel, on his talk on it, he says they're probably writing in cuneiform. So who's to say? But yeah, you're right. Why don't just write in ink instead of cuneiform? On clay.
Yeah.
I guess that's your more permanent things. Today, I guess when you print something on a special type of paper, you put a seal on it, that kind of thing. That's true. They did the seal. So we put seals on things even today, right? I don't know if, do you guys use seals in your country for legal documents or anything?
Sometimes, yes.
Yeah. So we have that too. Like, you'll have to put a seal on it. So they would probably have a seal on the clay. They didn't have such a way to put it. I guess they didn't have the same way to put on paper. So yeah, they had all those financial things. They had legal texts, a lot of magical stuff. I wonder with the magical stuff, you wonder, like, they always have all these spells, but they never seem to work. I don't know why they would, like, if they really work, why don't they just say, like, you know, have this guy die instead of having to send an army. Go get him.
Yes.
But although they maybe worked against the king, remember the Cimmerian king, Dogdami. We decided he was probably killed by magic.
Doug?
Yeah, King Doug for the Cimmerians.
Yeah. That's the one time magic worked.
Yeah, that was the one time it worked.
What good is a sword against sorcery?
Yes, isn't that what Conan said?
Yes.
Yeah. So I do get the feeling like kind of the library thing was sort of like that, that they were, he was, Ashurbanipal was looking for sorcery too.
Well, we have some real boring stuff from Sargon, like 1,300 administrative texts and letters. So Sargon, less interested in magic and more interested in keeping control.
That was probably Sennacherib too, right?
Probably.
Yeah, because he was his right-hand man.
There's a lot of royal grants and decrees from all the kings down to Adad-nirari III back in 810 BC.
I'm pretty sure, you know, pretty much everything that we have on Sennacherib, all the annals and stuff, all came out of these libraries, you know?
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting things in the library is 1,600 letters. So they are communications sent between people, and that should be pretty interesting. But there's been a lot of finds of letters in the rest of Assyria as well.
Yeah.
From Sargon onwards, when the postal service worked.
Yeah. And those letters are gold for historians when you find good ones, and, you know, they really... You know, because when you read Ashurbanipal, I'm the king of the world, I did this, I did that, you know, he's making some stuff up. And when you find these letters, the king, you know, I request this or that, that's how you really triangulate a lot of these stories. I think I just found where I could read the letters. The Oriental Institute in Chicago has resources where you could read the Rasim Cylinder and all these, and I get a lot of that. But the letters aren't there, but I think I recently found, it's a ton of books, but I think I found it digitized. So I'm going to start going through some of those letters and see if we find something cool in there too.
Please do.
Oh, there was a letter. How about the letter from, I believe it was one of the sisters. It was maybe like Ashurbanipal's sister or Esarhaddon's sister. And there's a letter from her to her sister-in-law saying about, you know, make sure you practice your writing. I heard you're not practicing your writing. And then there's, like I said, that letter from Shamasuma-Ukin to Ashurbanipal talking about when they were kids, which I think is so amazing because, you know, how they eventually went to war and tried to kill each other. You know, you kind of think, well, they're brothers, but maybe they didn't really know each other. But apparently they did.
Yeah, that's a good piece of information.
Yeah, right? Like, I would think, well, I probably had 50 brothers. He didn't really know that kid. But he did.
Yeah, Ashurbanipal was the annoying kid.
Yeah, I guess so. He probably, you know what? You're right. Ashurbanipal probably was totally annoying.
Yes, he was sitting there reading in a corner, and the other boys were like, oh, let's do sports. I was like, oh, no, I don't want to.
Yeah, he doesn't want to do it, and he's writing, but he's the guy who got you back. He's like Cartman. South Park.
Yes.
I'll show them all. There is a letter from Ashurbanipal when he was a boy to his father, Esarhaddon, and saying, I'm practicing my writing. What was that? I'm sorry.
Actually, it says that he's practicing his writing.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good for him.
Yeah. So there's... and so I wanted to talk just a second, too, about George Smith again. Because here's, this was really interesting. So George Smith, he's the guy, he's sort of like a firefly, you know? He burned out quick. So he did all that. He finds the Epic of Gilgamesh in the rubble, in the museum, deciphers it, goes back to Iraq, finds it again. But he couldn't, he just was too British. And he would argue with the Ottoman people, you know, he would say, oh, I have the right to go here. And they would want a little bribe. And he would, I am absolutely not going to give you a bribe, you know, that kind of thing. So they were like, fine, we'll take all your stuff. So they wouldn't get, you know, they wouldn't let him take it. And he had all these problems and couldn't handle sleeping in, you know, lice infested rooms and things like that. And he didn't have the most strength. And so he was only there, you know, within a year and he died. He was young. He was maybe in his 30s, and he had a wife and like six kids, and he died in, you know, overseas in the Middle East, you know, on his that expedition to try to get those other tablets. He found that piece that he needed, but he died doing it.
That's tragic.
So Rasim goes back years later, and then he found all this more stuff.
Wow.
And Rasim, this guy had a life too. I mean, the stories. They tapped him, right, to go. So in Abyssinia, which is like Ethiopia, the king was crazy. He was completely like a lunatic, insane. He would be your friend one day and then have you executed the next day. He captured all these British diplomats and people. So they send Rasim over to negotiate, So he captured him. The king kept him. He was in prison for 2 years in Ethiopia until an army had to come and save him. I mean, it's a whole story.
Yeah.
So, and Rassam also, when he went back, he found the Cyrus cylinder in Babylonia, in Babylon. Which is, yeah, I mean, that's another one. The Cyrus cylinder is like a huge, you know, well-known cylinder in cuneiform from Babylon, from Persia, from Cyrus. So he found that. He found some stuff from Nabonidus. So he also went to Babylon, too. And he found a whole bunch of stuff like that.
Amazing. I like to quote Austin Henry Lyard himself about the significance of the library. So this is what he says, quote, "We cannot overrate their value," speaking about the texts. "They furnish us with materials for the complete decipherment of the cuneiform character, for restoring the language and history of Assyria, and for inquiring into the customs, sciences, and we may perhaps even add literature of its people. The documents that have thus been discovered at Nineveh probably exceed all that have been afforded by the monuments of Egypt. But years must elapse before the innumerable fragments can be put together, and the inscriptions transcribed for the use of those in England and elsewhere may engage in the study of the cuneiform character." But I bet he didn't think that we would still be deciphering them.
I bet not. No. And we still are. I mean, I guess computers, you know, can't even still do it. I mean, I guess they do use some computers these days to help translate some of these languages and that kind of thing. But I remember Karen Radner said something like, if you want to learn cuneiform, it's not a bad job. And we need people to keep, you know, translating it.
So maybe that's a job tip after the pandemic. Learn cuneiform.
Yeah. Yeah. Could be. For all you young people out there, I'm definitely too old to learn it, I think.
And I must be clear that even though I sometimes speak badly about the British thieving campaign in the 19th century, I do love the British Museum. And what they have done is amazing.
It really is amazing.
I also enjoy Netflix, even if I talk badly about it sometimes.
I didn't get that at first, but I know exactly what you mean. Yeah, it really is a delicate subject, kind of. You know, like what if they didn't take it all and they said, "Well, this is just rubble," and they just lost it all. So, you know, is this where the civilizations were at a different point at that time, and the British just did what they did? But yeah, like, even like you said about how they, you know, they're only 11% through that now. In those days, they just went in like bulls in a china shop and just, you know, dug through, took as whatever they could, and they did smash and grab, like try to get statues and things like that.
Yeah, one must always be careful when condemning the actions of people in the past, because all the circumstances were so different.
That was very well said, Dan. Very well said.
Okay, is that it for the library?
I think so. I mean, we could, you know, I'm sure I'll listen to this podcast and I'll say, "Oh, we could have talked about that," and then I will if I bring it up. But for the listeners, I'll post the link to the book I talked about, the buried book, because it is a really good book. I tell you, I picked it up at the library on Friday and I was done with it by Monday. It was all the things that we talk about on the podcast about Assyria come from mostly from these digs, you know, that these guys found. And then we are going to do the Epic of Gilgamesh. We're going to have a special episode on that. That's why we didn't really dig into that here. We'll definitely talk about that in another episode. And yeah, I mean, that...
There's also me reading the first tablets of the Epic of Gilgamesh on the Fano History YouTube channel.
Oh.
I really got into that one Christmas.
Did you do the whole... You did the first tablet, you say?
I think I did like four or five.
Oh,
tablets.
All right. Because I'm gonna listen to them so that I could, as I just read the Epic of Gilgamesh, but I'm going to, you know, listen to it again. I'll listen to you do it. I think the listeners should go look for that.
We will continue with the 630s, but before we do that, we'll talk about what life was like in the Assyrian Empire, because it is. From all these letters, anteaters. There's a lot of mystery remaining about the Assyrians, but this period is the period we know the best. So we'll get into details about what it was like to be a citizen in the Assyrian Empire and what your daily life was like.
Yeah.
Because we've been talking about only the kings and the big campaigns and religion and stuff, but people lived their whole lives in the empire. And what was that like?
Right.
We'll get into that.
Yeah, we definitely
will. Then we'll get into the 630s and we'll see Ashurbanipal's mysterious fate.
Very mysterious.
Because they don't even know which year he died.
No. We don't. But yeah, that is going to be good. And because of the format of the podcast, we really couldn't get into the, you know, life of the Assyrians. You know, every 10 years, it's not like we could, it changed that much. So yeah, that's going to be a good podcast too.
Even if the Assyrians were more inventive than a lot of other peoples, they were very conservative. So we can imagine that life was fairly similar in the 8th century to the 7th century.
Absolutely. Definitely. You're dead on. I never knew much about the Assyrians until I started co-hosting this with you. And they're so amazing. I could almost become like Irving Finkel and just become an Assyriologist. amateur one, obviously.
Yes, and then we'll proceed towards the destruction of the empire in 612.
Mm-hmm. Sad.
Which is not a very hard date, actually. It's the fall of Nineveh, but the empire and the idea of it survives.
That is true. And
actually, Elam survives.
Right.
Somehow, for longer than the Assyrian Empire.
It does. It's just... My mind just, it's such a story, you know, and when I went to school for history, we didn't really talk about the Assyrians, and this is just such a, the whole thing, you know, I mean, it's just such a basis of our civilization today still from what started from the Assyrians, even though they were violent. It was a violent time.
Yes, indeed. Also, Urartu will survive the destruction. That would piss off Ashurnasirpal and Shalmaneser.
Yeah. Oh, you know what? We're also going to, it's funny, we're also going to be doing, I'm going to have a joint podcast with Sai from History with Sai.
Cool.
And we're going to talk about the initial beginning of the Assyrian Empire, because that's before the scope of the original podcast.
Oh, like the first,
yep.
And the middle Assyrian Empire?
This is just the very beginning, just like how did this Assyrian Empire get started?
Wow.
So that's going to be interesting.
Sargon would say that it started with Sargon the Great, but he's probably wrong.
Sargon the Great from Babylonia? Or Akkadian?
Oh, Akkad.
Oh, of Akkad. Yeah. Yeah, he's probably wrong. I don't think he's right. No. So, yeah.
Oh, wow. So a lot of great things coming up on the podcast.
Yeah. So subscribe to our podcast. If you're not already, get on the Facebook page. Send me a message, anything you want to talk about. We've been getting some fans involved. We have a new fan that I'm going to be doing that podcast with. So
that would be great. A real Assyrian.
Yeah, a real Assyrian. How about that? That's just from Sweden.
Yeah.
It's a great world.
Also, if you enjoy this podcast, please consider sponsoring us on Patreon. That's how we survive.
Please.
And how we have survived for so long.
Yes.
So patreon.com, search for Fan of History. If you're a Swedish listener, you can also swish a donation to the podcast, but send us a message on Facebook and you'll get the swish number.
Swish, huh? Is that like Venmo?
I don't know what Venmo
is. Oh, well, there you go.
I'm sure it's similar. It's a sort of payment service on your mobile phone.
That's what Venmo is.
Yeah.
Cool.
Good.
All right. So swish Dan some money or go on to Patreon and definitely like our Facebook page. Send me messages so I know you guys are out there. And we're going to be coming up with a lot of cool stuff.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Bernie.
Thank you, Dan.
And thank you to your researcher who was
Caitlin.
Good work, Caitlin.
Thanks, Caitlin. See you guys soon.
Cheers.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us on Patreon, patreon.com/fanofhistory. Just $1 an episode would help us out. Thanks, and see you next time.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.